special cases need special approaches. While this program provides a number of general models that should be considered in nearly all problem employee cases, there are some particular types of problems that call for specific approaches. We will consider five groups here: the emotionally disturbed, absentees, alcoholics, substance abusers, and the accident prone. First, the emotionally disturbed. By the emotionally disturbed, I do not mean the person who is momentarily upset, but the person whose emotions are so disrupted he is unable to function fully. Such a person needs immediate attention, and the supervisor can be instrumental in keeping him from going over the edge. Dr. Harry Levinson of the Levinson Institute is widely respected for his insights into applied psychology in the workplace. His research has identified three major signs to look for in determining whether an employee may be emotionally disturbed and in need of counseling. First, look for personality extremes. Most people experiencing emotional trouble don't flip-flop. They don't change their personality type. Rather, their normal character traits intensify. The shy person becomes reclusive and withdraws into a shell. The usually outgoing person becomes extremely extroverted and socializes with intensity. So look for the person who seems to be changing in the sense of amplifying or deepening who he is. Look for stress symptoms. At a second stage, when the employee finds no relief by withdrawing into self or projecting outward through activity, he may start to show signs of anxiety, tension, facial redness, heavy perspiration, or become jittery or panicky. This second stage of disturbance can then lead to the third stage, which is the out-of-control person. If the employee is unable to cope with the anxiety, he may break down altogether and lose control of behavior and emotions. The employee's thinking may become irrational and will not make sense to other people. It is at this time that behavior patterns will change remarkably. The quiet person becomes noisy. The normally very orderly person becomes disorderly. When a manager or supervisor spots any of these symptoms, Dr. Levinson suggests the administration of emotional first aid. Step 1, recognize the emotional disturbance. You don't have to be able to categorize it or label it, but if you're seeing a real change in or deterioration of behavior or personality, the symptoms of extreme anxiety, or anything that appears to be an emotional breakdown, then acknowledge that this is a person in trouble. Step 2, provide relief for the individual's acute distress by listening. The supervisor's major responsibility at this point is to give the employee a chance to vent some of the excess pressure. It is not a cure for the problem, but simply a way to get him calmed down for the moment. In this counseling session, you have to make a basic decision about whether the problem seems solvable by the employee working jointly with you and utilizing other resources the company may have available. Key point: cases that are beyond the limits of the manager's capability must be referred to a more specialized and appropriate source of help. The role of the manager at this point is not to try to solve the problem or play amateur psychologist, but rather to get this person to a professional who can provide meaningful assistance. One way to judge whether you can help the emotionally disturbed employee directly and to recognize the limitations of your helping is to use this rule of thumb. If you see no improvement after 2 and no more than 2 listening sessions, refer the employee to health professionals. The second particular type of problem employee we'll look at is the absentee. Professor P.J. Taylor of London University, former medical director of Shell Oil, found that 60% of absences were due to serious or chronic illness, and another 20% to acute short-term illnesses such as the flu. However, beware of the statistics that I'm citing because they're accurate only for the jobs measured in the particular corporations involved in this study. 80% of the absences that Dr. Taylor found to be caused by chronic or short-term illnesses could be considered justifiable absences. That is, they represent a cost of doing business that is truly beyond the capability of the employee to control. However, this is not true of the remaining 20% of absences. About half of these involve employees who are completely well, but claim illness in order to get another day off. The other half involve employees who feel slightly unwell and decide to stay home because of their bad attitude about the job. It is this 20% of the absenteeism that is subject to some management. Generally speaking, absenteeism can be reduced by the following steps. 1. Define and enforce the rules governing absences in your organization. 2. Be as consistent as possible in applying penalties and sanctions, such as loss of pay for the time missed. 3. Keep accurate records of lost time and target any particular employee whose absences are exceeding the acceptable average. In some cases, this is monitored by computer. 4. Determine with the employee why he is experiencing particular difficulty in getting to work on time or at all. Usually, the supervisor tries to remedy the absenteeism problem through counseling. While some absentees may respond to counseling, others will not. Counseling has some probability of working for the following people. First, those whose pressures off the job are so strong that they affect the employee's commitment to get to work. Second, employees whose work appears to them to be disagreeable and dissatisfying. Third, employees whose working relationship with others are unpleasant and distasteful. And four, those who develop a habit of absence or tardiness not based on an underlying serious problem and who could benefit from a straightforward word to the wise. On the other hand, it's been found that a counseling approach will probably not work with those employees for whom the pay level or the job itself holds no strong attraction. Off-hours activities have a greater appeal than on-the-job activities. The whole purpose of being absent is to inconvenience, punish, or disrupt the organization. For this latter group of employees, discharge may be the only appropriate course of action. The alcoholic employee is another particular problem employee type. The best possibility of saving alcoholic employees is to recognize them in the early stages, try to gain their confidence, help them talk out their problems, and refer them to professionals in the field. Start first with the company's own health care or employee assistance program if one exists. The most effective course is to approach suspected alcoholics with understanding and support, but be firm and confront the situation. Do not describe their behavior in moral terms or accuse them of being alcoholic. The primary objective for the manager is to get the employee into the hands of treatment professionals. Contrary to long-standing belief, recent evidence suggests that alcoholics are not likely to be absent more often on Monday or Friday, nor are they tardy more often than non-alcoholics. Professor Harrison M. Trice of Cornell University, who performed a major study of the job behavior of alcoholics, discovered that these widely held beliefs were not substantiated when an actual examination of alcoholic employees' attendance records was made. However, he suggests that the attendance record does remain a strong indicator of the presence of an alcoholic. Specifically, these points about attendance were found to apply to alcoholics. 1. Their overall absence rate will be higher than average. In fact, a high absence rate almost always accompanies an employee's development of drinking problems. 2. Their absences are spread out through the week so as not to draw attention to their condition. 3. Partial absenteeism is frequent, with alcoholics often leaving prior to the end of the shift, even though they may have been at work on time at the beginning of the day. An excellent summary of the approach that should be taken by the supervisor at work was published in a booklet entitled The Supervisor's Guide on Alcohol Abuse, published by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Specific suggestions for proceeding are: 1. Don't apologize for confronting the employee or raising the issue. 2. Encourage the employee to explain why his work performance behavior or attendance is deteriorating, and ask specifically about their use of alcohol. 3. Don't question their right to drink or make a moral issue out of it. 4. Make no suggestions that the employee use moderation or change his drinking habits. 5. Don't get sidetracked with the alcoholic's excuses for drinking, such as having a bad marriage or being in financial trouble. These other issues aren't your primary concern. 6. Don't be put off by any statement the alcoholic makes that he already is seeing someone about it, or that the health professional he consulted doesn't consider the drinking to be a problem. Even if the health professional did make such a statement, if they knew you were now taking disciplinary action with this person, they would probably take a more serious view of the problem. 7. Remember that this is a sick person. Like any other disease, this individual should be given the opportunity to be treated and rehabilitated. 8. Emphasize that your major concern as a supervisor is their poor work performance or behavior. A key point: at this stage in the discussion, you should firmly state that if there is no improvement, then administrative actions such as suspension or termination may be required. The employee should also be told that he bears the responsibility to seek professional help. 9. If at all possible, the supervisor should ask whether there is anything additional that the company can do. If the company has an employee assistance program or a health service, he should refer the employee to that service. One EAP administrator who has had 90% recovery rates among alcoholic government workers said,
"An employer, far better than family, clergy, or social agency, can lead an alcoholic to treatment by constructive coercion. Give an employee every chance to accept treatment, but make it clear that if he doesn't cooperate, he'll lose his job. This is proven to be more effective than the loss of friends and family."
The constructive coercion approach has been found to be the single most effective approach with these people because of the deep-seated nature of the problem they're battling. Here's an example of how the counseling discussion might be handled.
"Ted, I think it's important for us to talk about your performance and where things stand. We've already talked about your absence record, deadline problems, and the fall-off in the quality of your work."
"So why bring it up again?"
"I think what I'm seeing in your performance indicates a drinking problem. I have a lot of respect for you, Ted, but things just can't go on this way."
"What makes you think I have a drinking problem? I mean, everybody drinks socially in the office. Why single me out?"
"Well, there are several things that make me wonder. I've seen you drink rather heavily at some of the functions we've been at together. People in the office have even commented on it. And with other problems we've discussed, it seems like a plausible explanation."
"Well, you're wrong. I don't have a drinking problem."
"I'm not saying you do. I'm not an expert in these things, but I do owe it to you to tell you what I see and how the situation looks to me. The company has a treatment program for this sort of thing, and I think you should talk to a counselor and get some help."
"I won't do it. You're saying I'm a drunk, and you can't make me enter that program."
"Ted, listen to what I'm saying. You don't have to enter the program. But if you don't get some help and turn things around, pretty soon you're not going to have a job here. The reason I'm talking to you about this is because I care about you. To the extent that drinking is part of the problem, this program could go a long way toward helping you remedy the situation."
"Are you saying that if I go into this program, I won't be fired?"
"No. I'm saying that you have to improve your attendance record, meet deadlines, and have your work pass normal performance standards. Entering this program would indicate to me that you're making an effort to do that. Because I'm trying to support your effort to improve things, I'm suggesting this to you as a positive step. And I think you're responsible enough to face up to this thing and do what's right. Will you do it?"
"All right. But will you help me keep my job?"
"That's exactly what I'd like to do. You've got to understand that just entering the program isn't going to be enough. You've got to pull things together here, too. but the program buys you some time and should make it easier for you to make the other things happen. Have we got a deal?
Yeah. I appreciate you sticking with me on this. I guess it's time that I started getting things together.
Now let's take a look at the substance abuser as a problem employee. While addiction among employees in the United States is a growing problem, there is some evidence that suggests that it is not as prevalent as one might think. The drug experimentation of the 1970s has now become a multi-billion dollar epidemic. Yet some studies show increasing rejection of drug usage by various age groups and population segments. So is there really a problem or not? Because of the insidious and covert nature of the problem, many employers are left with nothing better than their own instincts to guide policy making. The best recommendation: assume you have a substantial minority of drug users on the payroll. Then, ask whether that makes a difference to your business. What should you look for in identifying the drug user? It is almost impossible for a drug user to maintain a regular attendance record. Therefore, many drug users tend to select temporary or irregular jobs or lower skill level jobs that don't require their full capabilities. Other users, including those in management, seek excuses for non-performance in their current jobs. They blame others, or in other ways, set up conditions that will cover their failure. Other behavioral symptoms of drug use tend to manifest themselves in terms of poor or erratic performance, forgetfulness, missing deadlines, not performing safely, or leaving work early. And also, the cost of the drug habit itself in many instances leads to theft. As with the alcoholic, there may be a number of physical symptoms of substance usage: pale or flushed skin color, frequent trips to the bathroom or to some location other than the work site, clammy skin, dilated pupils, slow response time in conversation, general nervousness or agitation if they're using uppers, or lethargy if they're using downers. Many of the same guidelines suggested for treatment of the alcoholic employee still apply. The role of the supervisor is to establish contact, build relationship and trust, and get the employee referred into the hands of competent professional help. Constructive coercion is called for because of the real hook that drugs represent in the person's life. The next special case is the accident-prone employee. All employees are subject to accident risk, but some employees are accidents looking for a place to happen. There is a psychological profile of the accident victim. His personality sets him up for having accidents. In one company, the Aetna found that a person who filed a workman's compensation claim had a 40% probability of being involved in another accident on the job and again filing a claim. Repeaters are found in occupational injuries in disproportionate numbers. It's important to understand that the accident-involved person is often an accident maker. This behavior comes from a form of mental illness. Dr. Gerald Jordan of the DuPont Company, with one of the best safety records of any company in the world, calls accident proneness a mental illness. Jordan says,
"Our studies have revealed a small group of individuals who encounter occupational injuries in disproportionate numbers. Obviously, there is something more than hard luck plaguing a person whose career shows a long series of injuries. It is the failure of the employee as a balanced person that is the core of his problem. He tends to evade the rules, both of working and of living. In most cases, the potential accident victim has a long service record and is well trained for his job. But all too often, he's a victim of his own bottled-up emotions, which he turns against himself."
The best course of action for the accident-prone employee is to discover them early and refuse to pamper them. Anytime you see a safety rule being violated, immediately jump into that situation. Safety first is a sound management philosophy in terms of preventing injury and cost for the company. But beyond that, by continually enforcing that philosophy, you signal to all in the workforce that you're not going to tolerate anyone who wants to hurt himself. Said DuPont's Dr. Jordan,
pampering the emotionally disturbed individual only serves to increase his demands and at the same time aggravates the severity of his illness.
Since the evidence is that the accident-prone employee is emotionally disturbed, counseling, referral to professionals, and if necessary, termination are the suggested courses of action. To summarize, while the general rules for problem employee management are covered under the 8 positive prevention steps and the 8 positive discipline steps, there are some cases whose special needs require special handling. I suggested some specialized guidelines for the emotionally disturbed, the absentee, the alcoholic, the substance abuser, and the accident prone. Beyond these guidelines, supervisors need to realize their own limitations and either refer those who are sick, such as the alcoholic, or tightly monitor and control those who are not, such as the absentee.